Today's episode of the Cloudcast is sponsored by Datadog, the monitoring platform for cloud scale infrastructure and applications. Datadog provides dashboarding, alerting, application performance monitoring, and log management in one tightly integrated platform so you can get end-to-end visibility quickly. And it integrates seamlessly with AWS so you can start monitoring EC2, RDS, ECS, and all your other AWS services in minutes. Visualize key metrics, set alerts to identify anomalies, and collaborate with your team to troubleshoot and fix issues fast. Sign up for a free trial today, and Datadog will send you a free t-shirt. Visit datadoghq.com/cloudcast to get started. That's datadoghq.com/cloudcast.
Cloudcast Media presents from the massive studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. This is The Cloudcast with Aaron Delp and Brian Gracely, bringing you the best of cloud computing from around the world.
Good morning, good evening, wherever you are, and welcome back to The Cloudcast. We are coming to you live from the massive Cloudcast studios here in Raleigh, North Carolina. Hope everybody's doing real well. We are wrapping up kind of the end of summer to a certain extent, at least the end of summer in terms of the kids getting ready to go back to school, if your kids haven't already gone back to school, or the kids in your neighborhood going back to school. So start to wrap that up. It changes everybody's sort of work-life dynamic when the kids are in school, getting them up early and all those things. But, you know, hope everybody's had a good summer. And let's get to the cloud news of the week a little bit this week. Not a lot, but a little bit of news, a little bit of speculation. So let's jump right into it. The first one is Microsoft acquired a company called jClarity. So jClarity is a company that has been working with, as Java has kind of unleashed themselves from the previous Java licensing that was controlled by Oracle, and now there is the OpenJDK and sort of various forms of people being able to get the JDK or OpenJDK. You know, I think what this is, and I've seen some speculation out there on Twitter and other things, is, you know, there's kind of a second round of companies trying to become your Java vendor and, you know, figure out where that is. So Microsoft making a play for jClarity, who had been part of trying to do a lot of work around OpenJDK. So it'd be interesting to watch the Java Wars sort of part two or part three, I guess, maybe part four, maybe, for those of you that follow Java very closely and kind of how it's moved from being Sun to Oracle to Open in the community, the fights in the community, and now, you know, what's going on with this going forward. So it'll be interesting to watch. The second thing, you know, kind of got some people's ires up. Was sort of interesting. AWS announced some new partner marketing guidelines. And the one that really got people kind of up in arms was that they put in there that they do not allow their partners, I think explicitly in, you know, branding or marketing with AWS, but they are not encouraging their partners to use the term multi-cloud. So obviously, you know, for a long, long time, Microsoft never wanted to acknowledge the word hybrid cloud. It was always just cloud and data center or, you know, some other term they would use for on-premises. They eventually started adopting the term hybrid cloud as they rolled out their own types of offerings, things like Snowball or Outposts and so forth. But they very much do not want you to acknowledge or mention that any other cloud exists out in the world. So it'd be very interesting, especially given kind of all the data that we see back from various analyst firms and from companies themselves saying, hey, they plan to have, or they will have, or they do have a multi-cloud strategy. So it'll be interesting to see how Amazon's kind of guidance, especially just even from a marketing perspective, but how that kind of trickles down to impacting different partners they have. And if partners are not necessarily on board with wanting to be all in on Amazon, how much Amazon amps up trying to build a service that competes directly with its partners. So not something that is unusual. We've seen that in the past where they will build services that are successful. So interesting just to sort of see this. Amazon has always been one, AWS has always been one that says, hey, we don't care about our competition. We're only focused on customers. That doesn't seem to be the case anymore. And then finally, and this is sort of speculation, but kind of speculation that seems to be pretty well founded in what'll probably happen. The stock market seems to agree that's probably going to happen, but a lot of word on the street that VMware is very likely to be buying Pivotal. Don't take that from me. Don't take this as investment advice, but kind of being reported and, you know, the word is that VMware is making a play at around $15 for Pivotal. The stock is jumped up from about $9 up to about $14 or so. It'll be interesting to see if this gets announced or if this actually happens, whether it's the week before VMworld or next week at VMworld. We could probably have an entire show to sort of dissect what this might mean. And if it does happen, we'll probably go ahead and dissect a little bit, kind of an interesting that it might happen. But, you know, it's out there. It's very likely to happen. There's lots of speculation in the stock market seems to think it's going to happen. So with that, I'm going to wrap up Cloud News of the Week. We have a very interesting guest this week, the folks from Flurry, who is a newer company. Actually, they are based here in North Carolina, just down the road in Winston-Salem. But a new company really kind of taking a different look at blockchain technologies and where they intersect with databases and some new types of use cases. So for those of you that you know, are interested in blockchain, this is going to be a very interesting episode for you. And for those of you that are, you know, curious as to whether it's real or not, or things that are use cases outside of cryptocurrencies, this will be an interesting episode for you as well. So let's get to the interview. Today's show is sponsored by DigitalOcean. DigitalOcean offers the simplest, most developer-friendly cloud platform. It's optimized to make managing and scaling apps easy with an intuitive API, multiple storage options, integrated firewalls and load balancers, a new managed Kubernetes service, and much more. From predictable pricing to flexible configurations to world-class customer support, you'll get access to all the infrastructure services you need to grow your business. Plus, DigitalOcean's community provides over 2,000 tutorials to help you stay up to date on the latest open source software, languages, and frameworks. So to get started on DigitalOcean for free, with a free $50 credit, go to do.co/cloudcast. That's do.co/cloudcast. And we're back. And folks, you know, we always are always looking out for new companies that are doing interesting things. And obviously, over the last 4 to 6 months or so, we've been trying to dive a little bit deeper into a lot of the data platforms, different database models that are out there. And we've heard from a lot of you that, you know, sometimes you'll get confused between, you know, it used to be just relational databases. Now there are lots of other things out there. And obviously, you know, as we've been talking about, there's a lot of different types of applications that are out there, a lot of different ways people are using data, a lot of things that are now in play in terms of what that means. And so we're always on the lookout for not only sort of new technologies, but companies that are bringing together a lot of these new technologies. So very, very interesting stuff going on today, and excited to have a new company and a company who's based out here in North Carolina, which always is sort of near and dear to our heart. So excited to have the CEO and co-founder of Flurry, Brian Platts. Brian, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here.
So before we jump into Flurry, which is your company, and kind of all the cool things you're doing technology-wise, give us a little bit of your background, because you have been an entrepreneur. You've done a lot of interesting things, but kind of give us a sense of some of the things you've done prior to Flurry, and then what motivated you and your co-founder to start the company.
Yeah, so I've been in enterprise software really most of my career. I started getting into tech and started my first tech company almost 25 years ago now. It seems like forever ago. But at that time, I was about 5 years into college for a degree that I never got after, you know, 7 years of trying. So lots of times I just think I had to do something else. But I started my first company and also started a community, which is still going on and thriving. Co-founded that with an individual, Jeffrey Zeldman, called A List Apart, which is now a book series. It's a event series, and it's still a tremendous resource today, but really focused more on building e-commerce and web applications. That was around 1995, and did that for about 10 years, and then sort of started to transition more into enterprise software. Most recently started also here in North Carolina, Silk Road Technology, which is a software as a service HR software company that still continues to, again, thrive today, but a pretty substantial organization there. And that is really a lot of that ended up influencing my thoughts into coming up with a new data management platform.
Interesting. Interesting. So I want to talk about the Flurry, the stack and the technology underneath it. But, you know, I feel like it's a little bit of a chicken and egg. Do we introduce sort of the challenges of it or the tech? Let's talk a little bit about kind of the types of problems that you guys are trying to solve. And to put this in context, folks, we're gonna get into the technology of it. It is very much data-centric, database-centric, blockchain is involved. But let's talk a little bit about kind of the types of application problems or use case problems that drove you to say, hey, we either need kind of a new data stack, data application platform, or, you know, why some of these new things were making sense. But from a, you know, application level, business level, what were some of the problems that you've seen over the last couple of years that drove you to want to create something new in this space?
Well, personally, we have dealt with, as we've grown software companies, most software companies end up growing partially by building new products, partially by acquisition. But there's always sort of that marketing component that when you have multiple products, you're always trying to bring them together in an integrated suite. And, you know, the integrating of those applications have taken down so many software companies because it ends up being an immense challenge. And it's a very data-focused challenge. So that is personally what really led us to think about how do we use today's technology and what we have available to break down those boundaries and accomplish some new efficiencies. But really just the economy as a whole and how we think about data is data focused. You know, you hear the concept data is the new oil, and the traditional data management approach. And of course, databases have evolved over the years, but they still sort of hold the identical position in our technology stack as they've held for 40 years. And 40 years ago, we were developing applications because they got us great human efficiencies. You know, they were doing calculations for us. It was the workflow of the application that we really got the value out of. Today, where most of the value comes out of is the data and the information. But we still really have an approach to application development that is application first and not data first. And that's really the philosophy that we've taken is that data is the most important thing. And we need to start thinking about data first and how we're building out solutions or building out the assets of our company. And applications should be thought of as windows into the data. They're the things that make you be able to effectively consume and get insights and interact with the data. But it's really the data that's the most valuable part. And we need a technology that takes that approach.
Yeah. Let me know if I'm thinking about this the right way. I think the way that you're framing it is, you know, in the past, we tended to build these sort of vertical silos where, you know, a data source was really only relevant to kind of the specific application that it was built on top of. The way that people would interact with that application were pretty specific. And nowadays, you know, not only do we have lots more sources of data, things that are creating data, whether it's, you know, through logs or sensors or whatever it might be, but we also have more and more where, because applications get distributed, you know, the data maybe end up being used or shared across a lot of different applications. And so, like, I think what you're getting at is if you start thinking from a data-centric perspective as opposed to kind of verticalness of one application tied to one data set, you've got to sort of break that previous relationship we used to have between the application and data so that the data can potentially be shareable, reusable in the way that we do things today, which is much more distributed, much more, whether it's microservices or just, you know, kind of multiple things coming at data sources.
Yeah. And in fact, I'm not sure I could have said it much better than you. But yeah, today, you know, historically, your data source, the database, had a single consumer, which is the application sitting in front of it that literally controls everything about it, controls the security around the data, all access to the data. Today it is more uncommon to have that scenario than it is the scenario where you have data, but it needs to be shared with many consumers, not just a single application. So we build mechanisms to get around that limit, what we feel is a limitation of the data base. So things like APIs, we think are a solution to a problem. The problem is all your data is controlled in one source and isn't easily accessible to the people who need it. So we have to build custom code in the form of APIs to get that data out or available to consumers. And it's interesting, it goes the other way too. We're now seeing, and you touched on this a little bit, we're seeing an application or a UI you can think of that someone's looking at or interacting with, not only needs data from multiple data sources. So an application needs to talk to multiple data sources, and the data source needs to talk to multiple applications. But yes, historically, there's a, you know, just a singular one-to-one relationship all the way down that stack, but it's not the world we live in. And the question is, do we still use sort of the traditional model like that? because it's the best tool, or do we use it because that's what we're used to using?
Right. Let's talk a little bit about the actual stack, the tech. Real quick before we jump into it, do you consider it as like a Flurry database, a Flurry application platform? Help me kind of terminology wise, so I have, you know, what do you call Flurry? Because there are multiple sort of layers to how you deliver things.
Yeah, it's a data management platform, which we think is sort of a higher level context. So databases are also a form of a data management platform, but right. We do incorporate some kind of app server capabilities in there that might not be in a traditional database.
Right, right. So let's talk about the components that are in the data platform. You know, to a certain extent, as we do with all things in technology, we have to draw them as a stack. but if I look at what's in essentially your stack and the platform, there's an element of it that is blockchain. We're going to talk about that and kind of the components of it. There's a part of it that is a query language, whether it's GraphQL or you know, you've got a sort of unique Flurry QL. And then there's some unique elements of it about you know, how you expose data at the data layer, as we mentioned, as opposed to the application layer. So let's talk about kind of why were some of the decisions made to make that part of your stack, and what are some of the benefits that come from whether it's blockchain or the query language and so forth. Just kind of walk folks through kind of what makes it somewhat unique, and then what are some of the problems that it solves versus, say, if somebody said, hey, I just started with, you know, MySQL or some other kind of common database they might know.
Yeah, so there's several layers to it that you can take advantage. But at its simplest form, if you, say, went to our website, downloaded Flurry, and fired it up on your laptop, it would operate as a graph database. And you can have your apps just start querying it and talking to it through GraphQL or Sparkle, which is another query language that we support natively, or a JSON query language called FlurryQL, which you mentioned. So your apps can just start talking to it, submitting data, et cetera. At its core, it's doing a couple different things. So one is that Flurry is always maintaining a history of every data change. So in an economy where data is important and we're sharing it, that data needs to be trustworthy. And so by default, every piece of information that's stored in the system has integrity and can be proven that it's never been tampered with. And sort of blockchain technologies and concepts play a significant role in this. So unlike a traditional database, you know, if you update a value, a price of a product in the database or something like that, it's literally considered what we call update in place. It destroys the old data. The old data is gone. It may exist in a log file for a while that you could restore in a backup for a little while, but at the database tier, effectively, it destroys that data. You can't get to the old value anymore. And using blockchain and our immutable ledger of changes, we have a history of every single change and a provable history of every single change. And we actually allow you to instantly query your data as of any historical moment in time, which is pretty cool and has some neat implications. The other core thing that it's doing differently is that we call them smart functions. And if people are familiar with the term smart contracts in the blockchain space, it's very similar, but it's instead of being kind of currency and asset focused, like most blockchains are, this is very data focused, but it allows you to actually embed business logic about your data, specifically permissions, who can update what, and different logic that might dictate the shape of the data. You know, if you're storing an email address as a string, you might want extra formatting to make sure it actually conforms to a proper email address. So those sort of rules. And those are things that are traditionally done in the app server. But again, if your data is getting shared across multiple applications or multiple consumers, it means that you're having to rewrite that business logic every single place that is accessing the data. And we really firmly believe in this concept that data should be able to defend itself. So if data is that important, it not only needs to be trustworthy, but it needs to defend itself so that any source that hooks into it, it's always secured. So those are a couple key differences over just a traditional database, but how you would end up getting to the data and querying it and updating it is in many ways, you know, similar to how you would do any other database, except for the fact, of course, that we're a graph database and not a relational or document style database.
Yeah. obviously, you know, blockchain, as of a couple of years ago, kind of came out. It was going to solve all of the world's data problems. It was going to change banking. It was going to do all those things. And then, you know, as with everything in technology, you know, people start going, okay, let's prove that out. Let's see if that works. And, you know, it's sort of had its, you know, people who love it, people who are detractors of it. Do you find that having to talk about blockchain as part of your platform is a positive? Is a negative? Or do you just say, look, we're going after the positive things that it does in terms of immutability, in terms of, you know, knowing who the sources of your data are, being able to build policy? I mean, is that something that people have to be concerned about, or is it just the byproduct of kind of some of the things that it does that benefits the bigger picture of what's possible with the Flurry platform?
It's a great question, because we did spend some time early on really trying to say we're not a cryptocurrency, because we really have nothing to do with that sort of angle. And that's what people often associate with blockchain. And of course, the sentiment around cryptocurrencies is constantly fluctuating.
Right.
But yeah, to your point, there's immense benefits and real innovation that exist in what blockchain does. Even though blockchain itself is the components that make up what blockchain does, there's not a single thing in there that is new. So these are all technologies and things we've been doing for a long time. I think like a lot of key technology innovations we have, it's when people assemble these technologies we're used to using or are familiar with, but assemble them in a new way to tackle a new problem. That's more the innovation. And that's really what blockchain itself at its core is. So there's, I guess, positives and negatives towards the blockchain connotation. But one thing that I can guarantee everybody is within, I don't know if it's the next 2 years, 5 years, or 10 years, people will end up using blockchain tens, maybe hundreds of times a day, and they'll never even know it or even think about it. Just like the early days of the internet, you know, everyone was thinking like, is this a separate product or is it part of our current products? And of course, our technology at that point really had little to no connectivity with anything outside of it. And now it's just part of every product. And it's something we use probably thousands of times a day and never even think about. And blockchain will be that at some point for people. And it should be that, because it shouldn't be something that is like deeply confusing or that you have to have some sort of computer science degree to be able to use. It should just be made to be easy to get the benefits from it. Just like over time, we've made the internet really easy to get the benefits from it.
Yeah. And I think we have this weird tendency in technology. And again, you know, partially it's because, you know, folks have been around for a while and they've done other things, and something new comes along, and part of kind of getting above the noise with something new is you kind of have to make, you know, somebody has to make some bold claims. I think the challenge sometimes is to get people to go, if you only look at it in the context of maybe what you did 10 years ago or 15 years ago, yeah, you may not necessarily love it because, hey, that other thing has had 10 or 15 years. But if you get to some of the core things that it does, and we see this sometimes with technologies like, and this is low level infrastructure stuff, but like containers, you know, when you start explaining to people the benefit of immutability, and you start saying, hey, look, you're not doing patching, you're not having to do other things, you can relate that again to immutability of data. It's like, you know, you're going to do auditing in a different way and probably in a better way. You're going to have, you know, not have to worry about, you'll still have to worry about breaches, but you'll think about breaches and data breaches in different ways. And I think it's always important for folks to kind of remember, we're not replacing technology with something new just to put a different coat of paint on it. There are going to be aspects of it that if that is the problem you're trying to solve, that's really, you know, that's the area to focus on. Don't necessarily look at it as the exact same thing as before. Sometimes we get, you know, wrapped up in the wrong axle in technology around that.
And we're not here to talk about containers, but it's a really good analogy. You know, when Docker and containerization came out, there was, of course, a very passionate group of people who were real advocates for it. But there was an immense amount of noise that, hey, isn't this just a virtual machine? We've had this for a while. We're using it all over the place. And it is Docker was one of those things where there really wasn't a whole lot new in Docker. It was using a capability that was built into the Linux kernel and had been there for some time, and some other capabilities, but they combined it in a new way that started to solve problems. And once people started to see the problems, it started to shed away. When they started to use it, it started to become clear how it really is very similar to virtual machines, but it really helps solve a bunch of other problems at the same time. People ask us sometimes with our time travel capability, you know, being able to query any instance or moment in time, like, wow, that sounds cool, but does it really matter? I mean, do we really need that? And once they start using it and sort of peeling back the layers, they start to see all the problems that just start to go away because of that capability. So it's one of those things that I think once people get their hands on some of these technologies and use it for a while, they'll start to understand how it affects their lives and what they're trying to accomplish.
Right. Right. Let's talk about some other things. Let's kind of get away from some of the blockchain stuff. Cause there's a lot of interesting kind of choices and things that are in there. And I want to put them in a broader context. So, we're not necessarily dealing with SQL queries anymore. We're dealing with GraphQL queries, which, you know, different sets of data, different ways of getting data. There's the model, the way that you think about presenting data at the data layer, right? From the database perspective, we talked about that, as opposed to binding it to the application. These are different approaches than we've had in the past. Relate that to some of the, you know, what you made some decisions in there. There's some capabilities in there. Relate those for folks to what does this mean in terms of either new ways of building applications or, you know, taking the burden for application developers, away from them for certain things that just sort of come with the platform now.
Yeah, so there's a number of things we're getting more and more accustomed to doing to build around what I would characterize as limitations of the traditional database or traditional database approach. And this sort of approach starts to peel those away. I mean, a big one would be our proclivity to creating data warehouses or data lakes. And part of that's a symptom that, you know, now an average mid-size organization is using over 500 software as a service products. All of them are storing data in data silos. And when we need to be able to access information across these, our only way of doing it is to try to combine them all together. And of course, a really common and favorite tool that some people are using for this is Elasticsearch, which is a really fantastic, simple tool for doing these cross data sort of queries or having a lot of flexibility. But it's also been one of the things that has led to some of our recent data breaches. It's not the original data sources that were compromised. It's that because people couldn't query across them, they copied all the data out of them, put them into yet another data source, and then that ended up getting exposed. So we need to start thinking about concepts in the semantic web, and I think we'll maybe end up talking a little bit about this, but really has laid a fantastic framework, not a complete framework, but a framework to the idea that we can interconnect data in different data sources without having to combine them and still get valuable, effectively, queries out of these things. So that's a huge area that I think we can tackle. Another big area that we can tackle is API management. We have, and as a software as a service provider myself with thousands of customers in my last company, you end up having, before you know it, you blink and you went from 10 APIs to 100 to 1,000 APIs. And it's because every new customer that needs their data in a slightly different format, of course, you end up having to create a new API or modify it. And then as you're updating your app, you're constantly trying to keep up with updating your APIs. And you end up, intentionally or not, typically embedding a lot of data security into your APIs. So now I got 1,000 APIs, each of which have some sort of data security rules in them. And which is fine as long as you can effectively manage. And this is where a lot of our security breaches happen, because it's really hard to have an inventory everything, the security around these systems. And I think GraphQL, and it's really great that people have embraced it so much, has shown people a window into a different way, which is instead of, you know, the app developer defining the interfaces, let the data consumers define the data they want in a query language effectively. I mean, GraphQL is more of an API language than a query language, but let the consumers define the data they want, and then we don't need to maintain all these APIs. So those are a couple examples of just where real cost, real security-related concerns come in to accomplish what we need to accomplish, because again, our data is so valuable. That's why we're building these sorts of things. But if we had a better data management technology at its core, we could avoid some of these and address these problems at its source.
Yeah, it's interesting that you highlight sort of the API management, API gateway challenge, because we've been through multiple iterations of API gateways. They're constantly having to make adaptations for, you know, essentially a layer of, it starts to beg the question of like, do we have to build all these API gateways around our data and our applications and so forth? Or, you know, should the approach start to be, like you said, build that around data as the source and think of them as sort of embedded policies, embedded types of things, as opposed to yet another device, another set of devices that you've got to maintain and manage and so forth. It does, especially as we're seeing more and more services sort of come together, it does start to make you wonder, why do we keep doing things kind of that old way, as opposed to looking at new models like the way that you have.
If we can embed the data security with the data itself, it means that we can effectively start taking our data sources and exposing them more directly on the web instead of hiding them behind layers of firewall. And of course, anybody who's been developing apps for a long time, that comment probably makes them shiver, because the idea of taking something like a MySQL or MongoDB and exposing it more broadly is something that we would never consider. I mean, that's what we protect. But again, it's because these were never built with the capability of securing the information within them. One of the things I love to point out about Bitcoin, and I said we're not a cryptocurrency, but one of the sort of light bulb things that sometimes comes on for people is that effectively Bitcoin is a database. I mean, it's a database with hard-coded rules in it. You can't define your own schema and stuff like that in it. But it is effectively a database, and it's a database that has literally been running in the public, not behind a firewall, now for 10 years. Anyone can participate in it. And if you could figure out a way to compromise it, you could literally become a billionaire. So there's definitely economic incentive to figure out a way to compromise this. Right. And in 10 years, it has never once been compromised. I mean, some exchanges around it were compromised, but the core technology never has been. So that's kind of weird. It's like a database, not behind firewalls. You could become a billionaire to hack it, but no one's been able to hack it. But that's the sort of integrity that we think all data should just have, and the confidence anyone should have to make their data readily available, because it is so valuable to the people that need it.
Yeah. There is a ton of stuff that we could dig into in the context of time. I want to be sort of conscious of your time running the company, but also, how much we can get into. Let me kind of ask you one last question, because we touched on a lot of things. I mean, we talked about, how this new approach can potentially be, valuable from a security perspective, auditing and exposing data directly and so forth. We talked about it from an API perspective, and there obviously there's a piece of that ties into developers. Have you found, given all the different ways that the Flurry platform could potentially help people, have you found that there's sort of one path or one use case, one type of thing that resonates more with people in terms of like, that's a problem I haven't been able to solve first? Or is it really, hey, there's a conversation you have with security teams, there's a conversation you have with app teams, and both of them are like, hey, boy, I wish I had that there. I'm trying to get a sense of, there are times when people have that immediate thing they want. Are you finding one one set of groups, whether it's security teams or app teams or API teams, have a bigger problem than others do?
Yeah, well, I think that because of the focus here around integrity of the information, anywhere where you have data that you feel like needs some sort of audit trail, or you need to prove to external parties that the data has integrity, is a good candidate. So any sort of regulated industry or anywhere where there's a lot of compliance around, these are very difficult characteristics to achieve in traditional ways. In fact, because we can't really achieve them with traditional databases, this is usually why we go hire auditors. We hire auditors to, you know, look through all of our financial records and have a third party that sort of says, yeah, it looks like they didn't manipulate these. But if we can actually trust the rules that govern the data and trust the data itself, some of these sort of roles start to shed or start to go away. So anywhere where there intense data integrity is needed is certainly one area. And another area is anywhere where we're challenging the concept of who owns data. So we have several of our customers that are doing things. I'll give an example of one, Fabric, which is allowing consumers to control their own demographic data and actually get paid directly by advertisers for releasing that information. And of course, their attempt is to cut out the Facebooks and the Googles of the world, who house all your demographic data and sell it. And of course, they collect all the money. Now they're kind of providing a service with that. In that scenario, you have to give the consumer absolute trust that their data is secure, their data has never been tampered with, and they control how that data is released and made available to people. And the technologies we provide actually enable that business model to take hold. So that's definitely another interesting case where we're kind of solving problems that are just extraordinarily difficult or challenging with traditional technologies. So those are a couple areas.
Yeah, no, and it sort of immediately makes sense. It's a little bit of the and I don't mean to paint this in a bad light, but it's sort of the old saying, you know, why do bank robbers go to banks? Well, because that's where the money is. If you can help lock down where people put value, whether it's data value or sort of monetary value, in ways that make it easier and like you've talked about, you know, kind of immediately secure, trustable, secure, traceable, secure. That seems like sort of an immediate place where people would not only find value, but be looking for new ways to do it. Because right now it is very, very difficult to make sure that you're always secure, you're always compliant, and not want to be on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. Where can people find out more about, you know, either wanting to pick your guys' brains about kind of what's in the stack, what are some of the use cases, or, you know, places where they may find you out and about at events and so forth? What's the best way to kind of engage with the Flurry team?
Yeah, our website is the best source to find all that information, which is www.flur.ee, FLUR.ee. And you can download our software for free. You can use it on, you know, personal projects, anything like that. We also have an on-demand version, which you can sign up for and actually use for free to a certain degree as well. So if people want to experiment with it, they can. And we also keep, you know, current news, events, and there's a link there to our documentation website, which has videos, tutorials, all kinds of information about Flurry and how it works there as well.
Okay, very, very cool. Well, with that, folks, I want to thank Brian so much for his time this morning. You know, really enjoyed it. As we mentioned, there's a ton of interesting technology that's going on in the stack, and I think it's important to kind of realize that it's not just, you know, there's technology in the stack, but there are some really big changes going on with applications, the way that we consume data, the way that we secure data, and Flurry is doing some very interesting things in terms of thinking about it in a new way and bringing the technology around it together to make it simple. So, Brian, thank you for the time today. Folks, as always, thank you for listening, for telling a friend, and for subscribing to the show. So with that, we are going to wrap it up for myself and for Aaron, and we will talk to you next week.
Thank you for listening to The Cloudcast. Please visit thecloudcast.net to find more shows, show notes, videos, and everything social media.